Well, good morning. I'm going to talk about some work in an ongoing study that I have with Peter Smolarkovich at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And what I'm doing is taking a model that's been developed by Peter with several other people over the past few years. It's a non-hydrostatic anelastic model for doing meteorological calculations. He's also doing some work more recently to extend it to the ocean. The model in recent years has been published in two basic forms. Earliest was in 1997. There was a paper by Peter and Len Margolin at Los Alamos. And in this form, the model was a mesoscale or regional type version. More recently, in the past year, 2001, the model was adapted to global type simulations. And this paper was by Smolarkovich, Margolin, and Vitigrowski. And this was published in JAS last year. And this was a global form of the model. And what my contribution has been is I've started with the global model and implemented throughout it rigorously coordinate transformation. It's a continuous. And so as a basic spin-off, what we can do with this is adapt grid lines to the details of the flow. Another byproduct is that we've been able to take both of these models and merge them into a single unified model, which we now call the multi-scale model for meteorological research. And the difference, whether we want to run it either as a regional or a global model, simply comes out in terms of the metric coefficients. And the way the code operates is just a flick of the switch to switch it from one to the other. Okay, the results that I'm going to talk about are going to be both some global simulation results and also regional simulation results. I'm going to talk about grid adaptation a bit. So this is how the talk is divided. The example number three, or part three there, which is the first example, that'll be the global simulation. We're looking at Hell-Torres flow. And so we'll see what happens. We're going to do some adaptation on the zonal jets, which tend to form, and see what that has to offer, if anything. That transformation is specified analytically, and so I'll show you the kind of function that gets used for that. The method can use an analytically specified transformation, but it's also capable of generating a grid numerically. It's just a matter of writing particular routines to do numerical grid generation. The second example, which is part four, this is a regional simulation. We're going to look at propagation of inertial gravity waves over about a 5,000 kilometer domain. And in this case, we have a numerical grid generator, which will kind of emphasize that aspect of the model. And then kind of some conclusions and summaries. Okay, so the first issue, why do we want to bother with grid adaptation in the meteorological models? Why on earth do we want to do something like this? Well, the quick answer is simply that maybe we can take points away from regions where there's not a whole lot of interest and focus them on regions where there is a lot of interest. To do this in a continuous fashion, which is the emphasis in this study, has some advantages. Most obvious is that it preserves the topology of the grid so that it has nice coding features. But there are some other things. Because we're using continuous transformations, certain invariants of the flow are a little bit easier to enforce. In particular, if we look at things like mass conservation, the solvers that we use, we can just write these solvers in their generic form, or take the generic form, solve them on a uniform grid in the computational space, or the transform space is the same, and no special modifications need to be made in order to adapt the grid points. I mean, this is handled completely in terms of metric coefficients, which are largely invisible to the solvers. The other issue, maybe a little bit more subtle, is that there are going to be other invariants of the flow. Let's, for instance, think in terms of the curvature of a surface. If we were doing a surface simulation, how do you make sure that the Riemannian curvature stays the same? Well, if you express this in a Euclidean space, there's an expression to calculate its value. That has to be an invariant of the flow. So since we're using continuous coordinate transformations, that thing tends to be preserved, at least with regards to truncation error. Okay, the idea of using continuous grid adaptation is by no means a guarantee that it's going to improve a climate simulation, but the typical view of the Earth gives some hope to the basic idea that it might be possible to borrow points from regions where there's not a lot of activity, because it's clear that things are not always crazy all over the place all the time. And so the idea is that there may at least be some hope that maybe by using grid adaptation we can improve perhaps regional forecasts, and maybe climate statistics generally. So. Okay, just a little bit of details about the model. I'm not going to get into a lot of nitty-gritty, but the basic thing that follows is we have anelastic and I also want to say non-hydrostatic model. And the anelastic representation has been developed following Lipson Hamblin, their 1982 paper, so it's appropriate for deep convection. I don't have it listed here as a bullet, but and also the simulations I'm going to talk about are dry computations. There's no thermodynamics, but the model does have thermodynamics in it, developed by Grabowski at NCAR, so it can handle not only atmospheric water vapor, but cloud water, and then precipitation in the form of ice and rain. And the ice can be fast and free-flowing. The whole parameterization is tuned to tropical convection, which is kind of Grabowski's interest. Okay, the generalized coordinates that we use, it's not by any means a new feature in the engineering community. It's 25 years old, basically, maybe a little bit more. Actually, I would say that there are papers in the literature that go back a long time, over a century, that show in one form or another some kind of coordinate transformation that people have been used to solve problems. But in terms of numerical grid generation, this paper by Thompson in 74 is recognized by a lot of people as kind of being a seminal point, saying, oh, look at what can be done. In the engineering community, grid generation is used to solve a lot of problems, and it's a very mature thing right now. Okay, the kind of mapping functions that I use, the basic idea is that they're all going to be C2 continuous, and that's because I want them to have a well-defined inverses. We have to be able to go back and forth. The transform coordinates, I'll show them in a moment, but generally are going to be functions of the independent variables, which in this case might be thought of as being the physical coordinates. The physical domain can be irregular. However, the transform domain is always uniform and stationary. How do we get the grid adaptation? This is kind of the key thing that we're interested in. Even if the domain doesn't change its shape, which, for instance, if we're working on the sphere, of course the domain doesn't change its shape, so that's kind of not real important. But how do we get the grid adaptation? Well, we can move the transform coordinates, those lines, we can move them around in the physical plane, or actually the viewpoint from the computational aspect. I mean, this is everything solved in the computational domain. What we really have are additional functions that give the physical coordinates in terms of the transform coordinates, and those are what we solve for. Okay, details of a little bit of the transformation. I use an identity transformation for time. X and Y are the horizontal coordinates. Z is the vertical coordinate. So we're kind of preserving that feature of the model, because the interest is in meteorological applications in this case. So the z coordinate in particular can be a function of all the other independent variables. The x and y coordinates, however, the horizontal, meridional, and zonal coordinates, are not functions of vertical. And so what does this do for us? It tends to keep vertical columns vertical, so that's kind of nice if you're doing thermodynamics. It makes analysis a little bit simpler. In terms of the transformation itself, though, it allows a separation in terms of the kind of transformation that we can use. We can write one transformation for the horizontal, another one for the vertical, and they're not directly coupled. Computationally, this works out to allowing us to do the transformation using just two-dimensional, one-dimensional matrices. Okay, and so that in general, the three-dimensional metric coefficients which have to be determined are calculated on the fly by multiplying these 2D against the 1D matrices. So a little bit of advantage in storage. Now, in our code, the Z transformation is a little bit special. We don't have it actually set up to do any kind of arbitrary transformation of vertical coordinate in terms of the others. But we use a similarity variable, which I've called zeta here. And you recognize that that's the standard terrain solid and coordinate transformation is, for instance, found in Clark. And in this case, so I have h, which is going to be the domain height, times the vertical altitude z minus z sub s. Z sub s is a surface mapping function, and this can allow the topography to vary, a standard thing. Z sub s, no, z sub s is,
oh, I see.
No, it's not. That's a typo. I'm sorry. That's wrong. It's a function of x, y, and t only. Yes, thank you. Okay, and in the special case where h of zeta, like some possible examples would be I could pick zeta to the n power and use these kind of power law distributions. If n is bigger than 1, then I would get a clustering of points near the surface. So that's kind of a nice thing to do. If I want to simulate pressure coordinates, we could let h of zeta be an exponential function of zeta. And then we can actually put in a scale height for the atmosphere and simulate pressure coordinates in that case, or sigma coordinates. If n is equal to 1, and so I just have the identity transformation for h, then in this case, what we've got are standard terrain following coordinates, such as would be found in Galchen and Somerville, with one exception. In this case, the z can be a function of t, so the time variability is allowed. And so that generalization was in a paper that I worked on with Peter and Rolando Garcia Dencar, published in 96 in JAS. Spherical coordinates, how would we implement spherical coordinates using these things? Well, we simply would normalize the zonal angle, lambda, and the meridional angle phi, multiply them by the radius of the Earth. And that gets them into x and y coordinates. Actually, there's a couple of things that I wanted to bring out here. No, not this one, next one. Okay, here's what the governing equations are going to look like, whether or not we solve the problem in a spherical domain or not. This is always the form of these things. Continuity, we have a solenoidal form of continuity equation. That's, you recognize that's a reasonable thing for the inelastic approximation, but actually what you may not realize is that when the coordinates are moving, it's not reasonable. Okay, when you have moving coordinates, you get a time term, so the continuity equation is actually elastic, even for the inelastic approximation. So we've done something in order to swallow up the time term. We've introduced a velocity which is called a solenoidal velocity, so I'll just circle this, and I'll give definitions of these on the next overhead. But this is one kind of velocity that we use, and the whole point of introducing this thing, which is called the solenoidal velocity, is simply so we can get this nice divergence-free form for continuity. In terms of the momentum equations, I have du, j, dt, and this uj is the physical velocity, and what we do in the model is we solve for the physical velocity in the physical plane. So for in Cartesian coordinates, it's the usual uvw. If we're in spherical coordinates, it would be the typical wind speeds that you measure at the surface. Okay, so we're not solving transformed velocities directly. And the ddt operator has still a third type of velocity, which is denoted with the u star, and that's the contravariant velocity. Okay, when you write these things in invariant form, typically, what you end up with is expressions in terms of contravariant velocities. Contravariant velocity is a tensor. So if you attempt to put these things in tensor form so that you get them in a shape that they don't change no matter what the coordinate system is, you end up with contravariant velocities. But in this case, if we have contravariant velocities throughout the formulation, we lose that solenoidal form for the continuity. There's going to be a time derivative, so it becomes an elastic continuity equation. And when we get to the momentum equations, they're much nastier because there's going to be a lot more shorts there'll be a lot more Christoffel symbols that appear. So by keeping physical velocity, there's some improvement here. Okay, the theta prime is the potential temperature perturbation in this case. And so we calculate that by subtracting off an environmental temperature profile and then dividing that by a basic state temperature profile. So we actually have two reference profiles in this model. For the inelastic model itself, it requires a reference state and hydrostatic balance. So we call this like a theta sub b, u sub b, p sub b, et cetera, et cetera. And in addition to that, we have an environmental state, which is in geostrophic balance. And so this theta prime, the perturbation is with respect to both of these. Okay. Okay, the velocities in this case, I just want to go over slightly what the different forms are. Again, the contravariant velocity, this one's a tensor, so it has the same form no matter what coordinate system you're in, and it has usual kind of tensor transformation to calculate it. That's not necessarily always the physical velocity, though. In Euclidean space, they're the same, but if you get into other spaces, that's not the case. And the reason for this is that the coordinates don't always have the dimension of length. And so you have to normalize the contravariant velocity, or I should say multiply it by appropriate scale factors to get physical dimensions. And that's how you determine what the physical velocity is. Now, this is what we actually solve for in the momentum equations directly. The solenoidal velocity, this one is defined by taking the contravariant velocity and subtracting from it the grid speed terms. Okay, and by doing this, we get rid of that time term in the continuity equation. Okay, in terms of the numerical approximations, just a little bit of detail on this one. To solve the evolution equations, we use a non-oscillatory forward in time, either Eulerian or semi-Lagrangian type of advection solver. And these things have been developed by Peter in conjunction with work with several colleagues in the past 10 years, basically. The basic idea behind the NFT algorithms are that these things preserve the sign, so they keep the solution positive definite and negative definite, depending upon what you've got. And also, they kill dispersive wiggles that might appear. And in terms of how to get rid of dispersive wiggles, MP data by itself can do some of that for fields that are close to zero. But when the background field is not close to zero, then you actually need to use some additional flux-corrected transport schemes to take care of this. Together, with the non-oscillatory machinery, we kind of really have what we term smart numerics. And that is, if the solution is very calm and smooth, these things don't come into play. On the other hand, if the solution begins to show lots of activity, then the numerics will adapt itself and adjust the right amount of dissipation to keep the solution stable. These things have an additional advantage. And they give us what we call an implicit subgrid scale turbulence model. And so it's actually possible to do the simulations without having something like explicit turbulence model. We can actually run it without one. And we've done some work and looked at a number of cases, including planetary boundary layers, isotropic decay of turbulence, some gravity wave simulations, a couple of other things. And to show that if you use the NFT scheme by itself without any turbulence model, that you get a very reasonable representation. It seems to be quite competitive with using standard turbulence feed models. As an option, we can also use Smegarinsky or TKE type of parameterization in the model. The elliptic equation that we get is for pressure. Basically, we take the momentum equations, write them in our discretized form, substitute those velocities into the definition of the solenoidal velocity, substitute those solenoidal velocities into the continuity equation. This generates the Poisson equation for pressure, and that gets solved using a conjugate residual solver. Got it. Okay, so the first simulation that I'm going to show you is for climate. And we have four basic simulations that we're going to look at. The grid's not real fine. It's a little bit on the coarse side, but I have two uniform grids, one which I call coarse, the U0 grid, the finer one, which is U2. The basic difference between them is that the U2 grid has double the Meridiano resolution. And we're kind of looking, I'm going to do an adaptation in terms of meridional structure. So that's really what I wanted to look at. And so we're going to use U2 as kind of the standard of comparison to look at. This is a Heltz-Suarez simulation. And this is what the standard result would kind of look like. We have potential temperature. These are zonal time averages for three-year simulation. In the upper right is zonal wind. This one is meridional wind and vertical. So those all have fairly reasonable profiles. Now what I want to focus on is what's the difference that resolution makes. And so I'm going to look at some instantaneous snapshots of the vertical wind field. On the left-hand side are results using the coarse resolution mesh with just 32 meridional nodes. And then this is the fine resolution mesh using 64 meridional nodes. And the one on the right corresponds to the figures that we just saw in the previous case. I'll leave that one up here. The thing I'd like to point out here is what do we see in terms of direct and indirect cells? The basic idea is that what I'm drawing are just the overall directions of the flows, and so I see three sets of cells, the direct Hadley and polar cells driven by buoyancy, and then in between the indirect feral cell. That's for the high resolution case. Now if I look at the low resolution case, the Hadley cell circulation is fairly clear, but the feral cell and the polar cells are not so clear. Okay, so by lowering the resolution we kind of lose that. So that's just something to look at. Now what we're going to do is do some zonal adaptation where we kind of focus on the zonal jets I have a polynomial for the transformation. The details are not really important, but it's a fifth order type of stretching, C2 continuous. And this is the kind of grid that this polynomial can generate. The one in the upper right here, that's actually close to the grid that was used to do the simulations. In this case, if I move the zonal bands together, then I would get a focusing at the equator. And it's also possible to add a zonal adaptivity, and then that thing can actually be rotated. These are some of the features of this particular transformation. So what's the impact of doing this? This shows a simulation in the first frame here. This is a uniform U0 grid result. So I'm starting with an initial condition. I have 32 nodes uniformly distributed in the meridional direction. And now I'm going to turn on the transformation and start adapting the grid while the simulation evolves. And what happens is that as the points begin to cluster in the zonal bands, I have first this instantaneous representation about a week later. Then here's another one. And finally, after the transformation is fully adapted, then I get this kind of result. And so what you can see is we are picking up these additional cells better. Although the representation at the poles is still not very good compared to the uniform high-resolution results, but if you recall from the previous figure, the resolution of the poles isn't all that high, so that's kind of where that happens. If you look at some elementary statistics, then we get things. If I look at the symmetry, for instance, if the statistics of the turbulence are truly stationary, then the meridional maximum meridional wind field, the symmetry, the wind field should be anti-symmetric from one side to the other. And so this column shows departure from symmetry. And basically, the uniform grid, and then I have two adapted cases, show errors in symmetry of about 2%, whereas the uniform grid is about 8%, so like four times. The uniform grid adaptation was set up so that it had double the resolution of the uniform grid in the region of interest. Okay, just a quick go over with a final simulation, which this is the inertial gravity wave simulation. We have two to compare. And basically we have these. Okay, basically in this case we have a lower cosine pulse, which is deflecting the bottom boundary of the computational domain. This is what's going to start the gravity waves. Uniform simulation result, this is uniform high simulation result, generates it like this. The cosine pulse starting at the left and then it moves all the way to the right, stops, and then goes back. And so these are the wave fields that get generated. I'll explain that momentarily, but yes. I've got those in there because we're going to compare that against the adapted result. Okay, to do the grid adaptation, what we've done for the grid generator is to actually use an evection scheme. And the basic idea is that if we solve using NP data, for instance, we're going to get the correct domain size because the total amount of grid size that's going to be conserved automatically. So we've done this as an evection problem for that reason. Here's what the grid looks like. And we've implemented a step function. And we have regions of low resolution. This is the grid metric. And when it's low, that means that there's packing. Okay, and when it's high, it means that the grids are widely spaced apart. And basically, we see that this thing is following along as it moves. And then here's the result actually using the adaptive grid. Now, if I compare this against this one, the coordinates are a little bit different. On the right-hand side, this has been computed in terms of physical coordinates, but on the right-hand side, this is plotted in terms of transform coordinates. When we get inside the gray area on both of these, they're different because this one's got twice the spacing of these guys. But if you look at the features, the four that are highlighted on the left are equal to the four cases on the right-hand side. And in terms of the images, they're almost identical. And so this simulation has been done using about half as many grid points. Okay, so I think at this point I'll stop because I realize I'm out of time.